I'd like, first of all, to thank you very much for the invitation. I'm very pleased to be here. And I have a handout here. So what I'm going to do is three things. First, I'm going to talk about some key aspects or some key ideas from Wittgenstein's lectures on aesthetics, trying to illustrate them. Okay, this will not be unfamiliar to you, but I hope to clarify a few things that is to my satisfaction. Then I want to apply some of the upshot of that to a couple of case studies in contemporary philosophical aesthetics. And finally, I want to say a few words to sort of justify my being here, the link of aesthetics and Wittgenstein's conception of philosophy, to tie that up with his idea of philosophy in general. Good. Wittgenstein begins his 1938 lectures on aesthetics, according to Gerald Smithies' notes, with the remark that the subject of aesthetics is very big and entirely misunderstood. What he means here by aesthetics is not the academic discipline of philosophical aesthetics, to which the lectures he gives contribute, of course, but its subject matter, namely our aesthetic judgments and reactions, both vis-à-vis works of art and also everyday objects. I mean, this is something about which Gerald Johannessen has worked, and I profited a lot from his piece, Wittgenstein, the Aesthetic Domain, where he looks very carefully at the use of the word aesthetics in Wittgenstein. So what I'm saying is very much a shortened version here, but he worked out much more carefully. Okay, so aesthetics is very big and entirely misunderstood. So about it being very big, what makes it so big, I think probably the inclusion of, everyday objects, not just works of art, but he talks about this, buying a suit at a tailor's, for example. So it's quite clear that he doesn't want us to limit our attention to art. And as for the other thing, the prevalent misunderstandings that Wittgenstein seems to have in mind here when he says it's entirely misunderstood, I suggest that is an understanding of the meaning of aesthetic reactions and aesthetic explanations. And these two terms I want to elucidate a little bit. So aesthetic reactions are specific criticisms, expressions of a directed discontent. For example, this door is too low, make it higher, someone he gives. Aesthetic explanations are answers to particular aesthetic puzzles. That is, puzzles about the effects a work of art has on us. We are uneasy or unclear about a specific aesthetic impression and are looking for a satisfactory explanation. Expression of what we've experienced. And such an aesthetic explanation, Wittgenstein is at pains to stress, cannot be a causal explanation, for that would not allay our disquietude, that would not help us with our problem. Rather, aesthetic puzzlement is typically cured by peculiar kinds of comparisons, by synoptic representations of relevant variations, or simply by identifying crucial details, perhaps details of the context to which we attribute the effect in question. The only criterion of correctness of such an explanation, and that is very important, I think, is that it satisfies me. Well, me at the time.
Don't bother about the others.
I'm trying to appear a little less selfish than I am. So that it removes someone and all of his client about the impression. Question. Now, here's an example of an aesthetic reaction drawn from an essay by Dr. Johnson, in which he discourses on the injury that grand imagery suffers from unsuitable language. He illustrates this view with the following passage from Macbeth, which is number one on your handout. Come, thick night, and pour thee in the dunnest smoke of hell, that my keen knife see not the wound it makes, nor haven't peeped through the blanket of the dark to cry, hold, hold. Johnson comments that the force of the poetry is greatly diminished by four inappropriately vulgar words, namely dun, which he says is now seldom heard but in the stable, knife, the name of an instrument used by butchers and cooks in the meanest employment, and peep and blanket, who, without some relaxation of his gravity, can hear of the avengers of guilt peeping through a blanket? Johnson. Now, Frank Chaffee cites part of this example, Johnson's censures on the word knife, in order to contradict Wittgenstein's claim that aesthetic reactions, which Chaffee here subsumes under aesthetic explanations, should not be construed as causal explanations. And Chaffee comments, as you have it, number two handout. Isn't it appropriate to protest that no one without an a priori notion of what constitutes permissible poetic diction should have suffered the disturbance of his attention to the counteraction of the words or the ideas? Yes, that's capitalization. Of which Johnson complained, to support this claim by appealing to the fact that those without such preconceptions, though as familiar as Johnson with the domestic associations of the word knife, just as capable of picking up the low words, do not undergo such disturbances of the attention. Isn't this an inductive procedure? In other words, Chaffee understands Johnson to put forward a causal hypothesis about the effect of low words upon readers of Shakespeare. And he submits that Johnson's hypothesis is false, that even readers who are aware of such words, domestic associations, will not regard their occurrence in this passage as an aesthetic flaw. Or if they do, that will be due to some prejudice about permissible poetic diction. Now, it's true that judgments such as Johnson's are often worded very much like an empirical generalization about readers' responses. But is that indeed what they are? Well, here's a test. Suppose that Johnson was to realize that most readers of Macbeth did not mind the use of those household words. Would he regard that as a falsification of his judgment? Probably not. He would rather deplore those readers' bad taste, their lack of poetic discrimination, which would show, I think, that his aesthetic judgment was not intended as an empirical generalization. Of course, Johnson has some preconceived ideas of what constitutes permissible poetic diction, but far from being a deplorable prejudice, such preconceived ideas constitute what Wittgenstein calls a culture taste. That is, a system of rules, standards of correctness shared by a culture or social group of a certain time on the basis of which they appreciate and criticize aesthetic objects. According to Wittgenstein, all the more developed and sophisticated arts depend on such conventional standards. Without them, aesthetic judgment could only be the most banal expressions of personal liking. How beautiful. No, that's not what we're interested in. Now, needless to say, different centuries have different cultural tastes, and so it's not at all surprising that Chaffee doesn't share Johnson's 18th century reaction to low words and tragedy. Even contemporaries belonging to the same culture will not always agree on relevant rules and standards for judging art, and that, I think, is especially obvious today, where radically different aesthetic orientations coexist in the same culture, typically defining themselves by a specific canon of admired works, admired by that group. So Wagenhauer, Stockhausen, or Led Zeppelin, or what have you. So you can easily find out what kind of group somebody belongs to by just hearing a bit about their heroes, as it were, the works they regard as canonical. And often there's very little communication between those different subgroups in the same culture. So whereas Johnson could expect at least a considerable part, perhaps a majority of his contemporary readers, to agree with his general aesthetic views, today one can usually only expect a proportionally much smaller subset of those who have aesthetic interests to share one's culture taste. That's the big picture, of course. Another discussion of a passage in Macbeth provides a useful example of the second key term, or a couple of key terms really, of an aesthetic puzzle and its resolution by an aesthetic explanation, in Wittgenstein's sense of the term. This is from Thomas de Quincey's famous essay on the knocking at the gate in Macbeth, first installment number 3 on the handout, where he poses the puzzle. From my boyish days, I had always felt a great perplexity on one point in Macbeth. It was this. The knocking at the gate, which succeeds to the murder of Duncan, produced to my feelings an effect for which I never could account. The effect was that it reflected back upon the murder a peculiar awfulness, the depth of solemnity. Yet, however obstinately I endeavoured with my understanding to comprehend this, for many years I never could see why it should produce such an effect. Again, Wittgenstein would emphasise that no causal, psychological investigation can resolve this kind of puzzle. For one thing, psychological experiments trying to establish the psychological effects of certain kinds of experiences need to be made, as Wittgenstein says, on a number of subjects. But de Quincey is not concerned with the way people generally respond to this element in the play. For all he knows, he may be the only one on whom the knocking at the gate has such a powerful effect. Now, admittedly, that is unlikely. Those who share de Quincey's general aesthetic outlook will be likely to share many of his aesthetic responses, including those of perplexity. Or at least, it will be possible to communicate to them a sense of such puzzlement and thus make them share it, as de Quincey obviously endeavours in his essay. Still, it's not inconceivable that some such aesthetic puzzlement may be idiosyncratic, and anyway, for resolving such a perplexity, it is quite immaterial whether others share it or not. Of course, there are also causal explanations that concern only one person. For instance, I may want to know why a certain kind of food gives me a headache. A causal explanation of such an allergic reaction doesn't require that anybody else suffers from the same allergy. In such a case, a causal investigation would try to identify the ingredient that triggered my reaction and the general causal laws according to which it comes about. Both the cause of the active ingredient of the food and the physiological processes it triggers would originally be unknown to me. Thus, research into this causal link would have to discover new facts underlying the exponendum and show them to be instances of general laws. De Quincey's problem is rather different. He doesn't want to discover new hidden details of the play, but only arrange the known phenomena in a way that highlights certain aspects. Most importantly, a successful explanation in this case will not depend on general causal laws, which need to be objectively established, but merely on de Quincey's subjective satisfaction. He's looking for a redescription of the relevant phenomena that will make his reaction appear reasonable or less puzzling to him. Thus, a crucial feature of this kind of explanation that sets it apart from causal explanations is that what seems right to the subject is right. The correct explanation is the one that satisfies me, that dissolves my sense of puzzlement. Now, here's the explanation that satisfied de Quincey, number four on the handout. We were to be made to feel that, during the scene of the murder, the human nature, i.e. the divine nature of love and mercy, spread through the heart of all creatures, and seldom utterly withdrawn from man, was gone, vanished, extinct, that the fiendish nature had taken its place. The murderers and the murder must be insulated, cut off by an immeasurable gulf from the ordinary tide and succession of human affairs. Hence it is that when the deed is done, when the work of darkness is perfect, and the world of darkness passes away like a pageantry in the clouds, the knocking at the gate is heard, and it makes known audibly that the reaction has commenced. The human has made its reflux upon the foolish. The pulses of life are beginning to beat again, and the re-establishment of the goings-on of the world in which we live first makes us profoundly sensible of the awful parenthesis that has suspended them. Another feature of aesthetic puzzlement that Wittgenstein stresses is that it is often cured by comparisons, that we've, of course, already talked quite a lot about that aspect of Wittgenstein's ideas. Comparisons between the impression of what makes the impression in question and other, perhaps more familiar phenomena. And again, de Quincey's discussion fits the bill. His solution of the puzzle of the aesthetic effect of knocking at the gate is further elaborated by the following analogy, that is number five on the handout. If the reader has ever been present in a vast metropolis on the day when some great national idol was carried in funeral pomp to his grave, and chancing to walk near the course through which it passed, has felt powerfully in the silent desertion of the streets, and the stagnation of ordinary business, the deep interest which at that moment was possessing the heart of man, if all at once he should hear the death-like stillness broken up by the sound of wheels rattling away from the scene and making known that the transitory vision was dissolved, he will be aware that at no moment was his sense of the complete suspension and pause in ordinary human concerns so full and affecting as at that moment when the suspension ceases, the goings-on of human life are suddenly resumed. So, being reminded of this experience from an entirely different area, we will, if we can see the similarity, find our impression of the knocking of Macbeth, if it is like to Quincy, less odd, more familiar and understandable. The discovery of a persuasive comparison can remove from a phenomenon its disquieting appearance of uniqueness and anomaly. That's the point that Wittgenstein makes also in non-aesthetic contexts. Wittgensteinian aesthetic explanations are not only employed to resolve puzzles. Sometimes the explanandum may simply be a striking aesthetic experience that we strive to understand better, to bring into clear consciousness. Perhaps something not easily describable that we want to capture by words and thus to clarify our feelings. First, a very simple example. In Anatole France's novel Thais, two characters, one virtuous, one sinful, live in different places, but meet, convert each other. Well, this is a very short summary of the book. Convert each other and part again in opposite directions. So the sinner goes into a monastery, while the originally virtuous man has become a sinner. So we're concerned only with the overall impression. Ian Forster suggests a neat description of the experience of the book's symmetrical form. This is number six on the handout. Just for the pleasure, without knowing why, and when the pleasure has passed, as it is now, and our minds are left free to explain it, a geometrical simile, such as an hourglass, will be found helpful. So the book is the shape of an axe, or hourglass, reflecting the way the two protagonists, their paths converge, cross, at the central moment and then diverge in opposite directions. Very simple, but I think quite neat example of an aesthetic explanation. Other examples of such synoptic aesthetic explanations that clarify one's experience by giving them a poignant expression are of course several remarks in which Wittgenstein himself tries to characterize the works of different composers and their relations to each other. An example of that is number 7. A Bruckner symphony can be said to have two beginnings, the beginning of the first idea and the beginning of the second idea. These two ideas stand to each other not as blood relations, but as man and woman. Again, Bruckner's 9th is a sort of protest against Beethoven's, and because of this becomes bearable, which as a sort of imitation it would not be. It stands to Beethoven's 9th very much as Lenau's Faust stands to Goethe's, which means as the Catholic to the enlightened. So much for a sketch of some key elements of Wittgenstein's lectures, the accounts for the explanation. And with that in mind, I'd like now to consider two major debates, very briefly, obviously, two major debates in contemporary philosophical aesthetics, namely the paradox of tragedy and the expressiveness of music. Okay. Quite a lot to cover in one talk, I know. Brevity will fulfill a function. The first, the paradox of tragedy, as poignantly presented by Hume, of course, in quotation 8 on the handout. It seems an unaccountable pleasure which the spectators of a well-written tragedy receive from sorrow, terror, anxiety, and other passions that are in themselves disagreeable and uneasy. The more they are touched and affected, the more are they delighted with the spectacle. How are we to account for the fact that we choose to watch for entertainment, theatrical, or today much more cinematographic representations of acts of violence and suffering, which should be rather painful to watch? As you know, I'm sure various answers have been suggested, and they can be grouped conveniently under three headings: A, hedonic; B, cognitivist; and C, therapeutic answers, respectively. Let me run through, very briefly, a few answers. So, hedonic answers to the paradox of tragedy agree with Hume that in spite of those apparently unpleasant elements, watching a tragedy is still a pleasurable experience. Well, one, some say that fictionality takes away the sting from otherwise painful. Knowledge that it's not real, that is enough to make it pleasurable. Others have suggested that to the affluent theatre goer, any kind of artificial excitement comes as a relief from the boredom of their dreary everyday life. I don't know why you laugh. related to this, or perhaps an extreme version of it, is a sentiment expressed by Faust, that Faust would desire to live and feel with greater intensity and greater breadth, so to share and undergo, if only imaginatively, all kinds of human experience, to become one with kind of the richness of human experience. Yes. Of course, you can understand this feeling if you have a typical 9-to-5 office job. Okay, three, a common view is that the beauty of artistic representation, so poetic language, skillful arrangement of scenes, dialogues, realistic representation of character, admirable performance of actors, and so on, can be strong enough to account for our enjoyment in spite of some disagreeable contents one has to put up with. Too much good, so many good things that make up for this unpleasant scene. Now, Hume, as you know, goes one step further. He says that the delights of artistic representation do not only outweigh the unpleasant elements, but change the hedonic colouring of what would otherwise be negative experiences. As he says, the whole impulse of those negative passions is converted into pleasure. But not only do the tragic contents not spoil our overall enjoyment of language and composition, they even enhance it. Number five, Nietzsche suggests that our pleasure in tragedy is to a large extent due to its displaying an unrealistic eloquence and intellectual brightness in people in extreme adversity, where life approaches abysses and men in reality usually lose their heads, and certainly linguistic felicity. Hence, the representation of suffering, even if not pleasant in itself, is seen as a prerequisite of a greatly edifying rhetorical experience. More recently, Susan Fagan has identified a rather different source of possible delight in tragedy. We sympathize with a hero's distress, which then gives us occasion to be pleased with ourselves for having such benevolent and sympathetic inclination. Moving on to the cognitivist heading, cognitivists, by contrast, do not try to argue that watching violence and suffering on stage is an agreeable business. It may indeed be very painful and not at all pleasant, but they say aesthetic value is not always to be measured in the pleasure it promises. Art can be shocking, disturbing, even painful, and yet worthwhile when it's a source of insight and understanding. So what we should expect from a good tragedy is not enjoyment, but insight in aspects of psychology or the human condition. In my catalogue, finally, there's of course the Aristotelian idea that tragedy has psychotherapeutic value, famous sentence, through pity and fear, tragedy achieves the catharsis of such emotions, as Aristotle says. That is, such disagreeable experiences can be beneficial, perhaps in the long run, by contributing to our mental equilibrium. On one reading of this notoriously problematic passage, difficult term, catharsis, they are beneficial by allowing us to let off a surplus of pent-up negative emotions. Or on another reading, the benefit is that we cleanse those emotions in us, whatever that may mean, etc., etc. So I'm not going into that. This is just by way of a brief survey of some of the answers that have been suggested to this paradox. So, who's right? Which is the correct solution to the paradox of tragedy? I think what Wittgenstein's remarks about aesthetic puzzles and explanations can teach us is that the problem is misconceived, and that any attempt to decide which is the correct answer is hopeless. If Wittgenstein is right, aesthetic puzzles are essentially concerned with individual responses to particular works of art. The right explanation is the one that I find resolves my puzzlement, satisfies me, even though it may not work for you. You may never have experienced the same puzzlement, or even if you did ask something like the same question, you may not be satisfied by the same kind of answer. In short, aesthetic explanations don't have the generality that current debates in philosophical aesthetics, such as the debate about the paradox of tragedy, tend to assume. The question cannot be answered at the level of abstraction at which philosophical debates usually move. Indeed, at such level of abstraction, there is not even a paradox, but only a very common human inclination, namely to be fascinated by tragic accidents and acts of violence. The press coverage given to the details of gruesome murder cases and horrific disasters in tabloid newspapers, and in some countries, I have to say, also in the broadsheet, is a clear indication that in general, people relish to read or hear about others' misfortunes. To ask a regular reader of the Daily Telegraph, or the Guardian for that matter, why they don't feel distressed by the scenes of violence in Hamlet would be utterly daft. If, however, you belong to the minority of people who don't care to read a minute account of how some 32-year-old accountant from Stevenage visited his parents in Slough and killed them both with an axe, if you don't enjoy reading about the details of that, then it's far from clear that you will enjoy watching the blinding of Gloucester in King Lear, or the murder of Macduff's wife and children in Macbeth, Lansky's version of it. However much you appreciate the language and the acting. So again, Hume's problem wouldn't be your problem, since you just don't experience this unaccountable pleasure, nor may you find any other aesthetic value in such scenes of extreme violence. In some cases, you may indeed think that the play was going to be better had those scenes been left out. On the other hand, there's nothing wrong with any of those suggested explanations, as long as we understand them to be different people's solutions to their respective puzzlements. If Hume finds that scenes that would normally distress him become edifying and a pleasure to watch when skillfully expressed in iambic pentameters, that negative emotions are, so to speak, converted into positive ones by the beauty of language, who can gainsay this account of his aesthetic experiences? Some readers may indeed realize that they had similar experiences which Hume's picture clarifies to them. Again, Nietzsche's keen enjoyment of occasions to hear people in the most difficult situations speak well and at length appeals to me as an explanation why I'm happy to watch people in such disagreeable situations. But it would hold little attraction for some spectators that insist on naturalistic drama, like the lady described by James Thurber, who complains that when Macduff finds Duncan's dead body, he says things like, "Confusion has broke open the Lord's anointed temple," whereas surely, she says, as an innocent man, he should rather have said something like, "My God, there's a body in here." Or again, if Susan Fagan can truthfully report that for her the distress of watching violent or tragic scenes on stage is outweighed by the self-conscious satisfaction she derives from finding herself able to sympathize with the victims, that is nothing we should quarrel with. At most, we can say that that is not anything we have experienced ourselves, or don't care to own up to. So in spite of the polemical tone in which these discussions are usually conducted, different authors' solutions to the so-called paradox of tragedy should not be seen as contradicting each other. Each presents, like De Quincey, a solution to his or her own aesthetic puzzle, an account of the values of tragedy or the tragedies this person has in mind that satisfies him, and perhaps people with similar tastes and sensitivities, but certainly not everybody. To expect that we should find a generally and objectively true solution to the paradox of tragedy is a misunderstanding of the nature of aesthetic problems. Frank Chaffee puts it nicely, I think, when he says about the kind of clarificatory non-causal remarks that Wittgenstein commends in his discussions of Freud and Fraser, but also in his lectures on aesthetics. Chaffee says, "We must mentally prefix them with a salutation to whom it may concern." I find that rather neat. That was the first case study. Now to another major issue in contemporary philosophical aesthetics, the expressiveness of instrumental music. It can appear puzzling that we describe music, even instrumental, purely instrumental music, in emotional terms. We call it cheerful, triumphant, angry, or mournful. This is puzzling because, to echo Wittgenstein, it is only of a living human being, of what resembles behaves like a living human being, that one can say he's cheerful, triumphant, angry, or mournful. Now, a promising explanation, and don't worry, I will not run through a list of them, in this case I focus only on one, a promising explanation of this phenomenon is Peter Kibbe's so-called contour theory. Kibbe's response to the reminder that only of a living being, what resembles a living being, can one say that it's angry or mournful, is quite so, but up to a point music can resemble a living human being, and therefore it can also be called angry or mournful. Number 9 on the handout is Kibbe. The mournful or angry quality of a musical passage is the result of some perceived affinity between it and the mournful or angry features of people, features of their appearance, their behavior, or the expressive sounds they utter. So Kibbe's model is the way we see sadness in a St. Bernard's face or in the drooping of a weeping widow, due to their resemblance with typical human expressions of sadness. Kibbe's explanation of the experience of hearing emotions in ancient instrumental music is, I believe, another example of an aesthetic explanation, or at least a schema of an aesthetic explanation to be fleshed out in a given phase of a particular piece of music. In Wittgenstein says that it's successful to the extent that one finds that it captures one's experience or dissolves one's sense of puzzlement. Moreover, just as Wittgenstein suggests, the kind of answer that Kibbe thinks dissolves the puzzle of music's expressiveness is indeed a series of comparisons. Music is described in terms of comparisons to expressive bodily movements or modulations of the voice. However, the current discussion of Kibbe's and other philosophers' explanations of musical expression, again, I think, tends to misunderstand the role of such an explanation should be expected to play. For example, Oswald Hanfling and Roger Scruton have raised the following objection to Kibbe's views, and it's not a quotation, just summing it up. They say the alleged resemblance is too tenuous and far-fetched. Perhaps there may be similarities between behavior or speech of a certain person, some aspects of the music, but why should that resemblance be so particularly important? After all, a piece of music is far more similar to other pieces of music than to anybody's expressive behavior. And there are striking dissimilarities between music and expressive behavior of a certain person as well. For example, the sounds that sad people typically make are disagreeable, whereas sad music is often very beautiful. So much for an objection that, for example, Hanfling and Scruton have raised. Now, this might be an objection to the claim that every listener must notice the resemblance in question and the resemblances in question is striking. But taking Kibbe's account as an aesthetic explanation or a schema that kind of aesthetic explanation in Wittgenstein's case, the objection is beside the point. Aesthetic explanations are relative to specific aesthetic explananda. And an aesthetic explanandum is somebody's puzzlement regarding an aesthetic experience, or more generally, somebody's disquiet about it, a sense that something more needs to be said about it for that person to understand it better. So if Kibbe, or somebody following his line, asks himself why an adagio sounds mournful to him, and then hits upon a more detailed metaphorical description of it, say that he hears in it in its rhythm the subdued and halting gait of a person in mourning, then that is not a hypothesis awaiting some further verification, but simply part of the expression of Kibbe's musical experience. It is covered by the special first-person authority we have over our expressions of what we feel and think. My experience is correctly characterized by whatever I can honestly say does characterize my experience. That others, such as Hampling or Scruton, may not be satisfied with this explanation only shows that they experience this music rather differently and are not grappling with exactly the same puzzlements or disquiet as Kibbe. As Wittgenstein says, number 10 on the handout, for the correctness of an aesthetic analysis must be agreement of the person to whom the analysis is given. In other words, Kibbe's explanation should be regarded as unassailable, but of more limited scope than he himself believes. So I'm kind of reinterpreting him a little bit in status this explanation should have. There are those that agree with the initial description of the music as said, but who find that it is not explicable in terms of the similarities Kibbe points out. Perhaps they will find some other analogy more apt and satisfactory, perhaps the analogy with a barren landscape. Or perhaps the description of music in emotional terms does not strike them as puzzling in the first place. It should be noted that what in Kibbe's account figures as an explanandum may for others simply be an explanans. Thus, Wittgenstein's explanations of aspects of pieces of music or composers are usually just laconic, metaphorical characterizations. For instance, that the fugato in the first movement of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony is bitterly ironic. This word, ironic, irony, for Wittgenstein captures and explains what is characteristic of this part of the music, what he found striking about it. The further question of how exactly the word irony fits this music, how this metaphor works, doesn't seem to bother Wittgenstein. Now, if questioned about it, would he have been able to elaborate, pointing to similarities between irony and speech and aspects of the first movement of the Ninth Symphony? I expect so, but it's not clear that such further explanation would go very far and be at all compelling to those who fail to hear any irony in the music in the first place. It is possible to be struck by resemblance without being able to identify any particular features that account for it. This is common enough in the case of straight physiognomic similarities, especially where one relies partly on one's memory. You know, that person looks just like my Uncle Fred. I couldn't say for the life of me what it is in his features that makes me say that. That is a common enough phenomenon, so it's hardly surprising that occasionally one may find it difficult or even impossible to give a more detailed account of a comparison between things of very different categories. Yeah, I'll skip a passage here, which mentions these models used. Don't dare to.
Fine, I've got a question now.
Okay, you can ask the question. Now, if in one sense Kibbe's account is more limited in scope than he intended, providing an explanation only for those who accept it as a satisfactory account, in another sense, it is, I believe, wider in scope. Kibbe wants to defend and explain only moderate expressive characterizations of music as opposed to what he regards as fanciful ones. As far as an emotion can be expressed in non-verbal bodily behavior, music can express it too by resembling that kind of behavior. But when emotion is essentially characterized by its intentional object, or by more complicated aspects of the situation, instrumental music, unable to represent those things, cannot on its own express that emotion, according to Kibbe. Thus, he says, it can express sadness, but not the sadness over the loss of a loved one. Rage, but not the rage over a lost penny. Nor the so-called platonic emotions, such as pride, shame, hope, or piety. Likewise, Stephen Davies argues for a limited scope of musical expressiveness, quotation number 11, if expressiveness is to be predicable of the music, there must be a wide coincidence in judgments of expressiveness by suitably qualified listeners under appropriate conditions. It is only with respect to broad categories of emotion, happiness versus sadness, for instance, that this consensus is achieved. I think this overlooks that the explanations in question are essentially comparisons or metaphors intended to capture an aspect of the music that somebody, but not necessarily everybody, finds striking. So three critical points. For one thing, illuminating metaphorical descriptions require a considerable degree of perceptiveness, imagination, and verbal proficiency. They are hardly majority responses. What the majority of subjects in a psychological test could be expected to come up with are indeed only the most common and trivial figurative predications like sad, happy, or angry. But the more interesting, more illuminating metaphorical descriptions of music are the more nuanced ones that will not immediately spring to everybody's lips. For another thing, mutually exclusive predications are not mutually exclusive when used metaphorically or in comparisons. Even if F and G are mutually incompatible predicates, so nothing can be literally F and G at the same time, it may well be possible to compare a person or a thing both to an F and to a G. Thus, a fierce and violent person may be compared equally aptly to a tiger or to a tornado. All such comparisons and metaphors import into the description of an object some apparently gratuitous specificity, because the object of comparison will always have features beyond the similarities on which the comparison hinges. So a tiger is not only fierce and violent, but also feline, furry, and beautiful, which may be relevant in this case. But there's nothing illegitimate in that, for after all, it is only a comparison, which does not claim that the object described shares all the features of the object of comparison. Let me illustrate that with an example by Alfred Brendel, who offers an account of the first movement of Beethoven's F major piano sonata, opus 54, partly in terms of form and texture, but partly in psychological terms, by way of an extended narrative metaphor, namely the story of Beauty and the Beast. And he says that the first theme is a minuet, it's a feminine gracefulness, whereas the second theme is rough, masculine, stamping octave, triplets, and in the development they affect each other. The Beast's virile stomping makes some impression on the lady. The recapitulation of the minuet has lost a bit of its naivety. The lady appears a little flirtatious, puts on airs and figurations. She, on the other hand, has a calming influence on him, and in the end, the Beast has been tamed, and the two so very different themes find together in a sort of matrimonial harmony. Now, Brendel does not make the fanciful claim that this movement is in actual fact the story of Beauty and the Beast. Of course not. That would be ridiculous. He only uses the story as an object of comparison, as a colorful and poignant way of describing musical structure and development. And finally, my third critical point. Again, for such a comparison to be successful, aesthetic explanation, it need not please the multitude, it need not please everybody. Simple similes and metaphors can be straightforwardly true or false, right? But others, especially those that try to capture what in non-figurative language is hard to describe, may be thought apt by some and rather far-fetched by others. After all, the question is not just whether the similarities on which the metaphor is based are really there, but whether they bring out well what is significant and characteristic in the object in question. Obviously, there's room for irresolvable disagreement. But if somebody finds such a comparison or metaphor persuasive, it is no objection that others dismiss it as far-fetched. 12, as Wittgenstein says in a lecture, if you make another person see what you see, but it still doesn't appeal to him, that is an end of the discussion. I have tried to clarify Wittgenstein's notion of an aesthetic explanation and considered some familiar examples of such aesthetic explanations in contemporary philosophical aesthetics, suggesting that if Wittgenstein is right, those explanations are often misunderstood, mistaken for, and disputed as general hypotheses. Now, one may well wonder how much of contemporary philosophical aesthetics is concerned with aesthetic questions in Wittgenstein's sense, questions that are not really philosophical questions, but belong to the area of art, music, and literary criticism. Clearly, not all of it, although Wittgenstein would in some cases accuse philosophers of wrongly trying to give general philosophical answers to what should be treated as specific questions about art, music, and literature, he does not deny that there are genuinely philosophical questions about art and aesthetic issues. So there is room, don't worry, there is room for philosophical aesthetics too. Indeed, Wittgenstein's 38 lectures are a case in point. For the most part, he does not try to resolve any particular aesthetic problems or puzzles, but to clear up or ward off misunderstandings about the nature of aesthetic problems, about the danger of conflating them with empirical problems requiring a causal explanation. And the debate about the concept of art, if and how it can be defined, I think is a prominent example of another genuinely philosophical issue in contemporary philosophical aesthetics. Now, I'd like to finish with a few remarks on the question whether the kind of explanation that characterizes aesthetic discourse has a place also in philosophy and other areas of philosophy, as you can take it. That is what, according to Moore, Wittgenstein suggested in his 1933 lectures, as we've already heard, 13 on the handout. He said that the same sort of reasons as in aesthetics were given not only in ethics, but also in philosophy, quite telling that ethics is not part of philosophy. And in 1937, and here we come to the famous quotation we've already talked about at length, queer resemblance between philosophical investigation and modern aesthetics. Right, some similarities are obvious enough. There are four bullet points on my handout. Aesthetic questions arise, according to Wittgenstein, on the background of a developed taste that essentially involves rules, whose importance is emphasized very much in the 1938 lectures. Likewise, the subject matter of philosophy and conceptual analysis is concerned with the rule-governed system of our language. Again, in both areas, an investigation is occasioned by a disquiet, a sense of uneasiness or puzzlement, which needs to be cured or resolved. The work is always entirely focused on specific problems. Wittgenstein has no time for systematic theory building, independent of any particular explanatory need. Again, in both areas, Wittgenstein emphasizes that the temptation to give causal explanations must be resisted. They would bypass our conceptual or aesthetic problems. Finally, rather in these areas, what we need are further descriptions, reminders of what we already know, synoptic representations illuminating comparisons. No new discoveries are to be expected. Rather, a new arrangement of familiar things is to change the way we look at them. Those are fairly obvious, fairly salient similarities. On the other hand, what seems to speak against this likening of philosophical to aesthetic explanations, is that whereas the latter are, as I try to bring out, correct when they satisfy us, essentially subjective, one wants to protest, surely, that in analytic philosophy, right is not simply whatever seems right to me or whatever seems right to the investigator. I believe the way to resolve this tension, which I think is a tension, there's obviously something right here that's pointing out this difference, the way to resolve it is to consider that philosophy, as conceived by Wittgenstein, has two parts. Usually, when we encounter a philosophical problem in an academic book or an article, it comes together with an attempted answer. People don't just, you know, publish questions. They try to give answers. A philosophical theory, in this case, we rarely discuss philosophical problems fresh and in isolation. We are almost always, from the beginning, concerned with the assessment of various existing answers to a given problem. These existing answers, or philosophical theories, are, according to Wittgenstein, subtle forms of nonsense. That is, of course, what's so provocative, so radical about Wittgenstein's philosophy, that it isn't to be peacefully kind of put aside other philosophies, that he tells them all that that's nonsense, somehow they don't like that. Hence, philosophical investigation is, to a large extent, concerned with showing the flaws and inconsistencies in some given philosophical teacher or theory. Thus, in the philosophical investigations, Wittgenstein occupies himself at some length with the dismantling of his own earlier philosophical theory about language, and later in the book he attacks a very natural, very common conception of psychological words, which is, roughly speaking, Cartesian dualism. This critical and destructive part of philosophy, I think, is markedly different from any investigation in aesthetics as described. However, once this negative task has been done, we get back to the original problem and try to resolve it in a way that eschews the temptation to concoct another nonsensical philosophical theory. Instead, we are to look for synoptic representations of the relevant aspects of our grammar, or for some persuasive comparisons with other phenomena that help to make the puzzling one appear less puzzling. This is the part of philosophy, I think, that resembles, or quite obviously resembles, aesthetics. For instance, Wittgenstein shows convincingly, to my mind, that linguistic meaning cannot be explained as being due to mental acts of meaning, something accompanying speech. That done, there remains a puzzle that agitated him, namely, what to make of the phenomenon of experiencing the meaning of a word in an instant. So, meaning is used, yeah, but how can you experience the meaning of a word in an instant? That's something Wittgenstein grapples with in the late 40s in quite some detail. And when he does so, the resemblance with an aesthetic investigation is fairly obvious. He's, for the most part, not concerned with the demolition of any philosophical theories. We don't have sort of passing, but that's not really the issue. But he's trying to dispel an abiding sense of puzzlement he has himself about this phenomenon of experiencing the meaning of a word in an instant. And what he's casting around for are comparisons that would put the phenomenon of experience of meaning into a perspective where it no longer appears baffling. The most prominent comparison that backfired a bit because it opened up another can of worms is, of course, aspect perception. Seeing as is also the sort of thing you can do in an instant for a time. You hope that might help him clear up this experiencing meaning in an instant business, but it didn't quite work. Raised further questions and made things even more complicated. But anyway, Here's a perplexing phenomenon encountered when thinking about conceptual relations that is very much like an aesthetic experience we don't fully understand, and the attempts to dissolve this kind of perplexity are markedly similar to what cures an aesthetic problem. Thank you.